We Unitarian Universalist ministers have, as so many of us do these days, a Facebook group of ministers, and we often share insights and whatnot. And this morning, my colleague, Nancy McDonald Wadd, posted that she had planned months ago to do this morning's sermon on civility. She did not mean for it to be a political sermon. It just turns out that if you preach on civility, it might be taken such a way. Nancy is preaching here this coming Sunday. She did her internship here in this congregation in the early 2000s. She serves now River Road Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Bethesda, Maryland, a 1,000-member Unitarian Universalist church, and she will be preaching here for our anniversary next week. So be sure to come and invite your friends. The sermon I'm preaching this morning by Charles Parker Connolly was written and delivered in 1956. I planned months ago to preach it this morning. It's not intended to be political, but I could not read it this morning and not think that it was. You can connect the dots all on your own. I've only made a few edits. I took out a couple of paragraphs. It's a little longer than we usually preach today, and I made the language about God to be gender inclusive, and it is otherwise pretty much as is. It's pretty good. So here it is. Our ancestors lived in a seemingly enormous world, constantly expanding with new discoveries. They lived at a slow pace with few new ideas. Because of their credulity and superstition, they often needed the rebuke of Montaigne. He said, "Man must be stark mad. He cannot make a worm, yet he will indeed be making gods by the dozen." We live today in a seemingly small world, constantly shrinking, at a high pace ever mounting, and with a veritable bewilderment of new ideas. This means for multitudes, mental indigestion. What do they need most? People need to revive an old unheeded proverb, "The good is always the worst enemy of the best." Why? Because people think the choice is between the good and the bad. They choose the good and feel quite complacent. They are like the Stephen Leacock horseman who jumped into his saddle and rode off in all directions. They got nowhere fast. They should have begun by realizing that they should select, first of all, the best, and then emphasize that adequately. Because in actual life, it is not the great variety of beliefs that we have that count so much as a few beliefs adequately emphasized. By these important beliefs, we are led to the lofty ideal of the great question now challenging us: what did Jesus emphasize most? I believe that is the most important question that could be raised in the modern pulpit. If I knew this was to be my last sermon, I would have chosen this theme. There could be no question about the right answer to it, as a Jewish lawyer asked that question, though he naturally converted it into the vernacular of his time. He said, "Master, which is the first and greatest commandment?" Jesus answered, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy mind and with all thy soul and with all thy strength. This is the first and greatest commandment." Jesus was not content to stop there, though he had answered the question, for he said, "And the second is like unto it, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two commandments hang all the law and all the prophets." Then the lawyer asked him precisely the right question. They do sometimes, you know, lawyers. He said, "Master, who then is my neighbor?" Jesus could have said, "Anyone you can help," but that would have been a very unpicturesque and forgettable statement. As it was, he was inspired to make a most important and beautiful reply, one of the loveliest things in all literature, the parable of the Good Samaritan. You recall that a certain man on the road from Jerusalem to Jericho was attacked by thieves. He was left wounded by the wayside. Two religious leaders, let us say men of religiosity, passed him unheeded. Then came a Samaritan. By the choice of the Samaritan for special commendation, Jesus must have shocked devout Jews, who really believed that Samaritans should be loathed. They ought to be loathed because they were double heretics. They disbelieved that Jerusalem was the center of the Jewish state and that the Jewish temple was the center of the Jewish religion. This Samaritan saw the wounded man, went to him, bound his wounds, put him on his own beast, conveyed him to the inn, and there provided for his future needs. Which of the three men, then, said Jesus, turning to the Jew, do you think was a good neighbor? And the lawyer answered, he who helped him. Then he turns to the lawyer and says, go thou and do likewise. It was as if he saw in that lawyer's ear a kind of celestial megaphone through which he could speak to posterity so that even some of you this morning sitting in your chairs may hear the music of a still small voice within, go thou and do likewise. In this most wonderful and important of all stories on earth, the story of Jesus and the lawyer, he has given us a brief resume of his philosophy. It may be summed up in this affirmation: according to Jesus, love is not a dogma of salvation, but a life of service. He believed that the greatest thing in God is God's love for humanity, which makes God lovable as well as loving, and therefore God should be loved. It is a rightful command, but it is even more an invitation to excellence. And he believed that the great thing in us is our capacity to love. This gives us reverence for ourselves and love for ourselves as a foundation of love for both God and humanity. This is quite at variance with our modern semantics, where we think of self-love as a synonym for pride and vanity, conceit, greediness. Jesus did not confine his emphasis upon these great ideas to this occasion alone, but on many other occasions he emphasized their importance. I shall ask you now to glance with me briefly out of a few of the most noteworthy of these occasions. First, an astounding incident, his story of the Last Judgment. You recall he represents all the people of the world surrounding the throne. He is seated there beside God. He arises, turns to those on his right and says, come, you blessed of God, into the mansions prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was in prison, and you came unto me. I was sick, and you visited me. But some of them protested, Lord, when did we ever see you in these conditions and help you? And he said, inasmuch as you have done it unto the least of these, my kin, you did it unto me. Then he turned to the others and said, depart from me, you wicked, for I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you took me not in. I was naked, and you clothed me not. I was in prison, and you came not unto me. I was sick, and you visited me not. They protested, but when did we ever see you in needs like this and neglect you? And he replied, inasmuch as you did it not unto the least of these, my kin, you did it not unto me. Jesus was not willing merely to teach and preach this. He wanted to live it abundantly, to exemplify it richly. So he went about doing good in a great variety of ways. He heals the sick. He comforted the sorrowing. He gave food to the hungry. He comforted those who mourned. He gave advice to those in need. He warned the heedless. And on one occasion, he even washed the disciples' feet, an act usually reserved for Greek slaves. In his parable of the prodigal son, one of the most beloved stories, Jesus likened the heavenly parent to a loving earthly father. The earthly father stands outside his door waiting with a forgiving heart and outstretched arms to receive the penitent. Once
Men brought a woman to Jesus. According to their ancient law, they had a right to smash out her life with stones. He said to them, "Let him who is without sin cast the first stone." They walked away in shame. He turned to the woman and said, "Neither do I condemn thee. Go and sin no more." Thus Jesus extolled the forgiveness of love rather than the vengeance of law. In Gethsemane, and coming events were casting a shadow before him. It was the shadow of a cross. He might possibly escape in the night, hide in obscurity, save his life, but that would be in violation of his teaching. He would be hiding his light under a bushel. He must let it shine. He might also, contrary to his teaching, seek to resist the evildoer, to raise a rebellion against Roman power. But this would expose them all to the ruthless extermination of Roman might. He felt he should go in love to the cross. On the cross, in agony, he lovingly comforted a penitent thief, and then he prayed. It wasn't a petition, as now translated. He believed his God was more loving than he, wiser than he, and more forgiving. So he prayed, "God, thou forgivest them, for they know not what they do." Soon, the great Galilean died. I believe Jesus was the greatest lover that ever lived because of the great variety of ways in which he emphasized, both by words and example, the meaning and glory of love. History warns us against the peril of substituting something else for that which Jesus emphasized most. For example, in the 17th century, a little more than 300 years ago, Catholics and Protestants repeated the same so-called Apostles' Creed. It's a glorification of the supernatural, and therefore it has no room in it for the central idea of love. Just as the Bethlehem Inn, according to the old story, had no room for the birth of the infant Jesus. You recall there isn't a single word between the affirmation, "He was born of the Virgin Mary," and "crucified under Pontius Pilate," as if there was nothing noteworthy in all his life, nothing noteworthy in his character, his example, his teaching, his warning, especially that warning, "Why callest thou me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say?" And that new commandment, "that ye shall love one another even as I have loved you." The result, inevitably, was that religion became an ecclesiastic, dogmatic, controversial thing. It led to quarrels, and quarrels to war. For 30 years, they killed one another by the millions and greatly reduced the population of Europe. That would have been impossible, don't you believe with me, if they had emphasized what Jesus emphasized most. Now, in the 20th century, by events speaking louder than words, history again is warning us that we are not emphasizing most what Jesus emphasized most, and that consequently, we are running the world on entirely too small an allowance of love to be safe. The high cost of living today is largely a result of the high cost of killing in the past, plus the high cost of preparing for more ruthless and costly killing in the future. The rapid acceleration of militarism in our day deserves at least a glance, for a glance suffices. At the beginning of World War II, the Allies were content to try to destroy Berlin block by block with blockbusters. And then they sought the scientists to give them city busters. They did. Japan surrendered, but it didn't lead to peace. It led to what is now properly called Cold War. A good phrase for war, breeding intervals between wars. We are witnessing now a far greater outpouring of wealth and ingenuity to make wars far more ruthless and destructive than ever before, until civilization itself is in peril. If Jesus were here, he would condemn all this, and he would remind us that we are not nearly as practical as we think. We think we are practical because we believe in running our factories with adequate capital to get enough labor-saving machinery and scientific management. Of course, that is wise, but he would insist that we should go down more deeply, that not out of our factories, but out of our hearts are the issues of life. We do not believe in capitalizing them properly, For love is the capital that brings out the wealth and glory of the human heart. He would condemn us for our foolish infatuation with science, our assumption that it is an automatic blessing. No, it is a blessing or a curse, according to our use of it. If we allow militarists to abuse it, it will be a curse to us and might destroy civilization itself. If we allow love to govern us, it will lead us into peace, prosperity, and progress. No, I do not believe that Jesus' teachings belong to a discredited period of antiquity, nor that they belong even to our bewildered, though wonderful age, but rather to an age of sanity in the years to come, when people will put away their warring madness, and with wisdom, righteousness, and love, make a kingdom of kinship, peace enduring, progress everlasting. Now, I want to end, but first I would like to insist that I find it very difficult to let go of this beautiful theme. I am in somewhat the plight of one of the characters in a favorite story of Mr. Lincoln. You recall how the hunters went out to shoot boars. They saw no sign of them and grew wary of carrying their guns. They stacked them against the trunks of trees and wandered about unarmed. Suddenly a boar charged them. They all scrambled up the trees into safety except one ran. He grasped the beast by his tusks, held on for dear life, and shouted to his comrades, "For heaven's sakes, boys, come down and help me let go." So I implore you to help me let go this beautiful theme by highly resolving with me to emphasize most what Jesus emphasized most, the love that would protect and glorify humankind. That's the sermon by Dr. Connolly. And my invitation to you is to do the same, to think of what you emphasize most, of all the values and worthy things to which you could give energy. What shall be first? Nationalism? Safety? Wealth? Your tribe? Or shall it be love, an expansive and radical love that leaves no one out? That's the invitation offered more than 2,000 years ago, and the invitation offered more than 50 years ago, and the invitation offered each and every day. May we go and do likewise. I invite you to rise in body or spirit, hymn number 18.